To us, it was an empire of incalculable value. But it might have been obtained by other means. The Southern Rebellion was largely the outgrowth of the Mexican War. Nations, like individuals, are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times. Americans have taken pride in building a country that stretches from sea to shining sea, but among those who voiced reservations about how it was built was none other than U.S. Grant, who wrote in his memoirs about the high price the United States paid for the territories it gained from a war with Mexico. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were Americans fighting for in the 1830s and 40s during the War of Texas Independence and the Mexican War? What were the motives behind President James K. Polk's expansionist foreign policy? Who were the major players opposing and supporting the war with Mexico? And what became of the war's veterans? Our guest is Amy Greenberg, professor of American History and Women's Studies at the Pennsylvania State University.
Oh, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
It seems to me that often when American history is taught, we jump from the American Revolution, the War of 1812, all the way to the Civil War, and we don't spend much time getting to know about the Mexican War, the 1846 to 1848 conflict. Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think that we really don't want to talk about it?
I definitely think people don't want to talk about it. The U.S.-Mexico War has been called the Forgotten War, and it was pretty quickly forgotten after the Civil War, and people to this day really don't know much about it. But it was a really important war. It was the first war that we fought not for principle, not because our freedom was at stake, but pretty clearly for land, in order to gain harbors on the Pacific coast, in order to secure Texas, and in order to fulfill our manifest destiny and create a continental empire.
Well, let's talk about that phrase, manifest destiny, because it seems to have such importance in American history. Can you talk about the origin of the phrase?
Manifest destiny was the idea that the United States was destined to spread. And I think actually the way that it was originally conceptualized, the United States was going to continue spreading down through South America. You hear people talking about that, up through Canada. And ultimately, the Americas would be entirely the United States. And as the United States, they would have democracy, bring democracy to people, capitalism, Christianity, Protestant Christianity. These were some of the elements of it. And the phrase was first used publicly in the 1830s and 1840s by democratic expansionists. And some people have said that it wasn't a deeply held belief, that it was more of a politically expedient ploy to gain land. But I've looked a lot at letters of Americans who were moving west and going down into Mexico, and a lot of people at the time seemed to have really believed that this was the future, that Mexico didn't deserve to own her land, the people there couldn't take advantage of it, and that Americans would ultimately go occupy that land and make good use of it.
In the 1830s and 40s, what was the thinking between slave and free states, and how did that affect expansionist ideas?
Well, that's a great question. Well, for the most part, people who owned slaves wanted to expand into land where they could grow cotton. So this is why Texas became a very popular site for Southerners to move into in the 1830s. And at the same time, Northerners really felt very strongly about Manifest Destiny, too, and they were trekking west, going to the Oregon Territory and looking to Canada, to Hawaii in some cases, to places where small farmers could have very profitable farms without slave labor. So it's a belief that a lot of people subscribe to, but it took very different forms depending on where you were.
So it sounds as if the whole country was spreading west but splitting horizontally as it went.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah, that's one way to think about it.
In an editorial in the Democratic Review, John O'Sullivan uses the phrase manifest destiny when he calls for, well, he refers to America's manifest destiny to overspread the continent allotted by Providence for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions. To what extent was population behind the spread, you know, this desire to populate all this land?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, one thing that's very interesting is that a lot of people in East Coast cities looked to Western expansion to solve the ills of increasing urbanization. Because one thing that happens in the 1830s and 1840s is that, well, first of all, people are having a lot of children here. So the population is increasing naturally, but it's a period of incredibly high immigration to the United States. In fact, in terms of population, it's the period of the biggest population increase from immigration in American history. And these immigrants, for the most part, are poor and they're moving into New York. New York triples in size in the 1840s, I think. And other cities are increasing likewise. Immigrants are moving into the cities and they appear to be causing problems of poverty. And a lot of people say, well, you know, if we can move populations out of East Coast cities, move them west, settle them on farms, it'll be better for democracy in general. And it'll be good for us and it'll be good for the continent as a whole.
And one of the places that they go in the 1830s then is Texas. But a lot of those are coming from where? Tennessee and Georgia?
Tennessee, Georgia, areas in the South that had been settled in previous decades by people moving from the East Coast. It's a lot of people, sort of peripatetic farmers who are looking for new and better land in order to grow cotton, which is a very profitable crop in the time period.
Only problem with Texas is you have to be, what, a Mexican Catholic to live there?
In order to move into Texas, which does belong to the newly independent Mexico, you need to become Catholic. You need to become a Mexican citizen. And then, worst of all, after 1829, you're not supposed to have any slaves. But this, because Mexico makes slavery illegal, but this doesn't stop Southerners from moving there, Southerners who are not Catholic, who have disdain for Catholics, and who are only very, very nominally Mexican. So it's a lot of Americans. Americans outnumber Mexicans in Texas 10 to 1 within a decade of first moving down there.
And what does, at this point in the 1830s, what does Mexico think? I mean, in terms of, first of all, what kind of stability is there in terms of the political structure, and as they're looking at Texas or California or the areas of the Southwest, what is their concept?
Well, when Mexico gained independence from Spain, it faced a problem, and that problem was that it's a very big country that was extremely centralized in Mexico City. The northern provinces of Mexico were not of general interest to most people in Mexico City. It was hard to make a living there, in part because there were very restrictive trade laws in Mexico, and there just weren't a lot of Mexicans living in these northern provinces. And so Mexico thought, in order to keep the area secure, in order to keep it part of Mexico, we have to encourage settlement there. And they thought, well, why not invite Americans to move in, stabilize the population, protect the region from raids by Indian tribes, and increase the economic viability of the area. And that's true both in Texas and to a lesser degree in California.
They didn't know their Americans very well. They hadn't read their recent history.
In retrospect, it seems clearly like a big mistake. But at the time, I think it probably made sense.
And so at what point does it become a tipping point where Americans are looking for an independent Republic of Texas?
Pretty soon after Mexico makes slavery illegal, I would say. But, you know, from the very beginning, the first settlers that go down there, they complain about the fact that they have very limited political rights, which is actually true. People in Texas have very little representation in Mexico City compared to what Americans think is their due as members of the greatest democracy on earth. The Catholicism thing is an issue. So, you know, one historian has actually said that the entire Texas Revolution was really a filibustering expedition. In the way that the term filibustering was used in the period, it basically meant a movement by mercenaries in order to free foreign territory and make it part of the United States without any governmental sanction. And the Texas Rebellion, for the most part, was fought by men who were from Tennessee, who weren't settled in Texas very long, and whose intentions very clearly were to bring this area of Mexico under U.S. control.
And did slavery, the desire to have slaves there, then play much of a role?
There's no question. There's no question. The settlers of Texas were overwhelmingly slave owners. And support of Texas annexation, if you look at it nationally, the vast majority of it came from people who were looking to expand the power of the South. So people there on the ground were looking for a nice place for slavery, and the nation at large was split between people who thought the annexation of Texas was a good idea because it would bring more slave territory into the country, and people who thought it was a bad idea because they didn't want to see slave territory
increase. And what was the flashpoint?
What was the flashpoint? The flashpoint was when President John Tyler negotiated a secret treaty with Texas, inviting it to become part of the Union at the end of 1844.
That could raise some hackles in Mexico City.
That was the problem. And previous to that, after the Texas Revolution, U.S. presidents had very openly said, we are not interested in annexing you because it will cause a war with Mexico. Also, there was a question of a disputed boundary. Texas claimed land all the way down to the Rio Grande, which traditionally that land had belonged to the neighboring province of New Mexico. And in fact, Texas also claimed that Santa Fe was part of Texas, which so was kind of a difficult argument to support. So there was this question of a boundary. And in fact, Mexico had never recognized Texas's independence. They maintained that Texas was a rebel province. And so, you know, most political figures knew that annexing Texas would start an international conflict.
What is the outcome then of the Texas Revolution? I mean, is the Alamo the culmination of that, or revenge against the Alamo?
What's interesting about how nobody can remember the U.S.-Mexico War is nobody can forget the Alamo.
Right.
So, and I haven't actually been able to figure out why that is, why the Alamo is this incredible flashpoint and important thing in the memory of a lot of people, not just in Texas. And in Texas, you know, it's basically a shrine, but nobody can remember the war that follows that. The Alamo becomes important to people because it's considered this moment when Americans show their backbone, when they make this stand after this enormous number of troops under General Lopez de Santa Anna, who comes north from Mexico City to enforce Mexico's power over this rebel province. All of the Americans in the Alamo die. And so it becomes this sort of like martyrdom type of shrine. And in fact, it's after that that Americans in Texas are able to capture Santa Anna when he's taking a siesta and force him to sign a treaty recognizing the freedom of Texas and the independence of Texas, which then is disavowed by Mexico as a whole. They say he was forced to sign this. In fact, he wasn't a real representative of the government. In fact, he had sort of assumed a dictatorship position at the time. And then that's sort of the stalemate. That's where we are in the 1830s. And from that point up until 1844, you have Texas as an independent republic. In name, it is recognized by the United States. And Mexico would like to see it come back.
Mexico was essentially just a power vacuum at this point.
Yeah, Mexico suffered. You know, Mexico's biggest problem, actually, you could definitely argue that the reason that Mexico lost the U.S.-Mexico War is because of the incredible political instability. There were repeated coups and overthrows of the government during the time period. Nobody was in power for very long. And so, yeah, that caused some problems.
I'm curious, have you looked at the way the whole Alamo and that conflict is discussed in Mexican textbooks, Mexican history books? Because I'm curious, you know, if in American schools we're sort of given the remember the Alamo and the martyrdom story, I'm just curious how it's described on the other side.
I haven't looked into that much. I know that there is a real difference of opinion in Mexico about what actually happened at the Alamo. And in part, one big issue that comes out of it is whether or not Davy Crockett and several of the other
surrendered or died fighting.
Or died fighting, exactly. You know what's going on here. And there are several sources in Spanish that maintain that they surrendered and then were executed by Santa Anna afterwards, which a lot of pro-Alamo supporters in the United States say absolutely isn't the case.
It's interesting how we still argue over, you know, what happened at that point. And what about American leadership, presidencies and figures that made a difference in how things came out?
Andrew Jackson was president when Texas became independent, and he very clearly said, I'm sorry, you know, we can recognize you, but there's no way that we're annexing you. That's not going to happen. And Sam Houston, who was the president of Texas, was a very good friend of Andrew Jackson's, and this was clearly his desire to see Texas join the Union. And so Jackson was not in support of that. Martin Van Buren, very clearly not in support of it. At the time, there are two political parties in the United States, the Whigs and the Democrats, and they are national parties, and they are both pretty clearly committed to not increasing sectional conflict and not starting a war with Mexico. So in the election of 1844, this is a very kind of key moment in the road to war, you have a sitting president, John Tyler, who was the first man to ascend to the presidency after the death as vice president after the death of sitting president William Henry Harrison. And he has been kicked out of his own party. He's no longer a Whig. He tries to join the Democratic Party. They won't have him. He's a man without a party, and he's looking for an issue that will enable him, he thinks, to win an election, become president on his own terms through the support of the American public, and he sees Texas as that issue. And in fact, the annexation of Texas was pretty nationally popular. People thought it was a good idea for the most part, particularly in the South and in the West. And so he negotiates a secret treaty with Texas, presents it jointly to the House and the Senate, and tries to get it passed, and he fails. But at this point, it looks like the front runners for the nomination of the two main parties are Henry Clay, the standard bearer of the Whig Party, who very clearly has said Texas annexation is a terrible idea, and Martin Van Buren, who had been president earlier, who looks like he's going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And he writes a memo that basically says, I don't think annexing Texas is a good idea either. And at this point, James K. Polk, this dark horse candidate from Tennessee, begins to get a lot of support from Democrats who are interested in the annexation of Texas. And he ends up becoming the nominee of the Democratic Party on a very clearly expansionist platform. And it's after he is elected that this attempt to annex Texas through Congress and the Senate jointly voting on it passes. So when James K. Polk becomes president, he enters the office. Texas is now a state in the Union, and Mexico's mad. Very mad. They recall their diplomat. They make it clear that they think that this is an act of war on the part of the United States. And Polk plays on this. He sends troops down into Texas under Zachary Taylor. He tells Zachary Taylor to take the troops down into the disputed area south of the Nueces and north of the Rio Grande River. And Mexican troops cross the Rio Grande and fire on U.S. soldiers. And at this point, Polk goes in front of Congress and he says, well, American blood has been shed on American soil.
And what motivated Polk? I mean, is it mostly the desire for land? Is it the desire to spread slavery? Is it political attention? What's his...
What a great question. I think, well, Polk is from Tennessee, and I think he believes firmly in manifest destiny. He is also a slaveholder, and he believes that the South needs to increase in its size in order to counter the increasing size and power of the North and the Union. So it's really both things. He wants to see the increase in slave territory, but he really is a real believer in manifest destiny. He sees Western expansion in the same terms, really, that Thomas Jefferson did as a good thing in order to increase democracy by making a lot of voters out of small landholders as opposed to people living in cities, that this is how democracy is going to flourish.
Democracy with slavery. There's a little irony there.
Yes, that's true. It wasn't seen as a contradiction by many people at the time.
And it evolved that way, of course. Democracy did.
Of course it did. And at the time, we must remember that slavery is enshrined in the Constitution, so Southerners don't really see any contradiction here at all. But, you know, I have to say that when Polk ran for president, as a lot of people know, he ran on the platform 5440 or fight. And that was in reference to the Oregon Territory, which we jointly held with Great Britain, and the Oregon Territory extended up through what is today British Columbia. And Polk claimed, or at least his supporters believed he claimed in the North, that as soon as he became president, he was going to press Great Britain in order to get the entire Oregon Territory.
All the way up through British Columbia.
All the way up through British Columbia. Vancouver Island would be ours. All of the ski resorts that are in British Columbia today, you know, Whistler Blackcomb would be part of the United States.
Some great national parks.
It's incredibly beautiful. It does make one think. I mean, not to be, you know, a current day expansionist, but
just make for a funny looking country, though, I've always thought. But he, somewhere in this process, settled for 49 degrees.
He did. He split it right down the middle with Great Britain. Did that pretty quickly and expediently, and he lost a lot of support in the North when he did that. Well, it was seen as a great betrayal.
We'll find out who the major players were in the Mexican War, both pro and con, and you might be surprised at some of those who opposed it. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. Thank you. Santa Ana's Retreat from Buena Vista by Stephen Foster, who apparently thought it was a fairly congenial affair, part of the Mexican War, which we're discussing during this hour of University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Amy Greenberg. We talked about major players, and I suppose we should start with Santa Anna on the Mexican side and then see who else.
General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. He is the great heroic slash tragic figure of Mexico in this time period. He becomes president, is deposed, becomes president, is deposed repeatedly. A lot of Mexicans were not willing to forgive him for giving up Texas in the Texas Revolution. Many others saw him as the only hope of stabilizing and unifying a fractured country and leading Mexico to victory over the United States. So he comes back into power. He has a plan that he is going to take his entire army to the northern part of the country from Mexico City and face General Zachary Taylor's troops and destroy the U.S. Army.
And with what aim in particular? Is it revenge? Is it the desire for the land? Is it a matter of principle?
Well, at this point, the United States has already invaded Mexico, won several important victories south of Texas and the north of Mexico, in particular at Monterrey. And so America is, you know, it's in Mexican territory. So, you know, Mexico has to respond.
So this is defense.
This is defense.
And Zachary Taylor, then, what kind of a general is he facing Santa Anna?
Zachary Taylor was known as Old Rough and Ready, and he was a very beloved figure among his troops. He fought several extremely bloody but successful battles in the north of Mexico at the outset of the war. And European observers would have put their money on Santa Anna in a meeting between these two generals. European observers, for the most part, thought Mexico's chances in this war were very good. Mexico was fighting at home. Santa Anna was classically trained in military maneuvers. Zachary Taylor was somewhat untested. He wasn't a very impressive figure in the minds of a lot of people, but he was very tough.
And what kind of weapons? And I mean, is this horseback and guns? Is this, you know, when these conflicts take place, what actually is happening?
That's a great question. There's a perception in the United States that the Mexican War is won by American volunteers who are fighting hand-to-hand combat with guns and are defeating Mexico in hand-to-hand combat in a very heroic manner. In point of fact, the U.S. manages to win most of their battles through the use of artillery and, in particular, cannons. We have much, much better artillery than Mexico does. And military historians who have examined this say that almost every battle actually was won not by any individual skill on the part of soldiers, but by the use of artillery.
Did the Mexicans win any?
No, unfortunately,
they
didn't.
It was just a series of one retreat after
another? Well, depending on how you consider some stuff that happened in California after the Bear Flag Revolt, there is one skirmish in California that you could argue that Mexico won. But no, it's one defeat after another. And probably the most tragic one for Mexico is the defeat at Buena Vista, when there are 20,000 Mexican soldiers under the command of Santa Anna and 5,000 American soldiers, and Santa Anna retreats on the second day when Taylor and his guys kind of thought that they were beat. So the first day of fighting, extremely bloody, a lot of loss of life on both sides. Americans wake up the next morning, Santa Anna's army is gone.
And why is that? I mean, was it the perception of superior weaponry, the cannons, just sort of...
You know, I honestly, Santa Anna repeatedly does things like this that are sort of inexplicable, and he never explains. He says he basically was going back to get reinforcements. He was regathering his troops. He didn't see it as a retreat. In the eyes of Americans, it's just sort of providence. They're incredibly lucky. But he does this over and over again throughout the war.
And what are some of the American figures that are going to become important later, like in the Civil War, that play a role during this conflict?
Well, one interesting thing about the Mexican War is it's seen as sort of the staging ground for military leaders who are going to become really important in the Civil War. Almost every major Civil War general gets his initial military experience in the Mexican War. And, of course, we talked about Ulysses Grant already. He was an officer in this conflict. a really important officer in the conflict was Robert E. Lee, who was responsible pretty much for the victory at Cerro Gordo, which was the probably number two most lauded victory of the war. In Cerro Gordo in central Mexico, as General Winfield Scott's troops were marching from Veracruz towards the capital, he figured out a way to go up on top of a hill, bring some cannons up there, and fire down on the Mexican army, which they did not expect to happen. And so he was an important figure in this war as well.
And Zachary Taylor's son-in-law?
Oh, Zachary Taylor's son-in-law, yes.
A man named Jefferson Davis also involved?
Jefferson Davis was also an officer in this war, and he was important, I would say more so in retrospect, because after the war, when Mexican War soldiers are attempting to get pensions, attempts to get pensions for them are blocked by the Republican Congress in the decades after the Civil War, in large part because they say, you know what, if we give pensions to Mexican War veterans, Jefferson Davis will get a pension, which is unacceptable. And Jefferson Davis actually
so throw
has
out
to
the
say,
whole lot of them.
Jefferson Davis says, you know, I won't take a pension.
And what sort of position did Abraham Lincoln take about this war?
Abraham Lincoln is a young congressman from Illinois, and he's a Whig. And he is one of the few Whigs who has the backbone to stand up and say in Congress, I don't believe you, to James K. Polk. When Polk says American blood has been shed on American soil, Lincoln says, show me where American blood was shed on American soil, because it's pretty widely known that Polk had provoked the war by sending American troops into an area that was more or less legitimately claimed by Mexico.
This is Lincoln speaking to Congress on January 12, 1848. Speaking of James K. Polk, he says, as I have before said, he knows not where he is. He is a bewildered, confounded, and miserably perplexed man. God grant he may be able to show there is not something about his conscience more painful than all his mental perplexity. And he, as you mentioned, also says in that same speech, where on American soil was American blood shed by Mexicans? And he says that the problem with the war was that there was not enough truth behind Polk's assertion as to why we got into it. Was this a war that was declared constitutionally through Congress?
You know, I'm not actually sure of the answer to that. Polk went to Congress and he asked for permission to conduct the war, but at that point, hostilities had already broken out.
So no declaration of war. Another problem, I suspect, for those who like to go according to the Constitution.
I found it interesting just looking at some of the comments of U.S. Grant, where he seems to see some of the negatives about the Mexican conflict, but he also talks about how experience proves that the man who obstructs a war in which his nation is engaged, no matter whether right or wrong, occupies no enviable place in life or history. How did it affect someone like Lincoln that he had come out in against?
Well, I don't think it helped him at all. I mean, this was a war that was extremely popular. The problem facing the Whigs is that they were very conscious of what happened to the Federalist Party. And the Federalist Party basically shot itself in the head when it met at the Hartford Convention in 1814 in opposition to the War of 1812, right at the moment when the U.S. was winning its victory in New Orleans, the Battle of New Orleans. So basically, the Federalist Party ended up looking non-patriotic, and they stopped being a nationally viable party after the War of 1812, which they opposed. So the Whigs are thinking about this very clearly, and there are very few Whigs in Congress in the 1840s who are in support of the annexation of Texas. A lot of Southern Whigs aren't even in support of the annexation of Texas. Northern Whigs definitely aren't. There's almost no support for the U.S.-Mexico War in New England. But the Whigs vote in favor of the war. They go along with it for exactly this reason.
Well, when Henry David Thoreau writes about the Mexican War and the fact that he's not going to pay his taxes because he doesn't want to support a government that has slavery or a government that is engaged in a war of what he sees imperialism, really, he makes it sound as if it's not a popular war. He says in the opening paragraph of Civil Disobedience, witness the present Mexican War, the work of comparatively a few individuals using the standing government as their tool, for in the outset the people would not have consented to this measure. If you had polled all the Americans at this point in 1846, 7, 8, Would they have been in favor, do you think?
Yeah, I think Thoreau's wrong.
Thoreau's just like, that's wishful thinking on his part.
He's hearing a different drummer drumming.
Maybe around Concord, there isn't that much support for it. No, the center of anti-war thought in the time period is definitely New England. But nationally, it is a very, very popular war. Popular in Illinois. I mean, you know, Abraham Lincoln, he has to go back to his constituencies. Illinois sends tons of volunteers to the U.S.-Mexico War.
How do they behave down there, those American troops? How clean a war is this?
Well, you know, again, this is one of the strange things about this war. It's a war that in the perception of Americans is fought and won by volunteers. In fact, it is the regular troops of the Army who does most of the hard fighting. The Army is a very, very low status organization at this time period. It's mostly full of immigrants. It pays very, very poorly. People don't have a lot of respect for the standing army, but they have a lot of respect for volunteers and for the idea of volunteering. The problem is that these much vaunted volunteers who everybody is claiming are so heroic actually aren't that disciplined. So they get down to Mexico and they don't behave very well. They treat Mexican civilians somewhat callously and in many situations pretty badly. There are a number of atrocities that are publicly talked about back in the United States. In particular, the volunteers of Arkansas, who are known as the Rackensackers, are so out of control in their treatment of Mexican civilians. They kill 24 Mexican civilians at one point over a matter which really none of the civilians had anything involved in or not involved in any way. And Zachary Taylor is so disgusted by the volunteers, particularly the Arkansas ones, but also volunteers from Texas, that he wants to send them all back home.
Winfield Scott, General Winfield Scott, is quoted as saying, "If only a tenth of the horror stories were true, it was enough to make heaven weep and every American of Christian morals blush for his country."
Yeah.
But there's not a growing anti-war movement?
There is a growing anti-war movement. There is a growing anti-war movement. The Whigs take control of Congress in 1848. And in large part, that's in response to the war, which, even though the war only lasts about 16 months, is seen to be dragging on by Americans. So it's one of many wars in American history where at the outset there's a lot of public support, and that public support gradually begins to drain away.
That's another thing, actually, that Lincoln mentions in that same speech, as he says that General Scott had been driven into disfavor, if not disgrace, by Polk for intimating that peace could not be conquered in less than 3 or 4 months. But now at the end of about 20 months, during which time our arms have given us the most splendid successes, the president is still saying we need more time.
Yeah, well, once Winfield Scott occupies Mexico City, it's all over for Mexico. So it's just a matter of them coming to the table, agreeing on a treaty. Nicholas Trist was sent down by Polk to negotiate a treaty. He actually is recalled by Polk, but he pays no attention to his recall from Polk, stays to negotiate a treaty, and he and his Mexican counterparts hammer out the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in early 1848 after quite a period of time of occupation of Mexico City. And once America occupies Mexico City, the country has been subjugated, and a lot of expansionists at home think that maybe we shouldn't just limit ourselves to taking California and New Mexico. Maybe we should take Baja California, maybe Sonora. Maybe we should actually take all of Mexico, claim it all. I mean, why not? We're the conqueror. We're the victors. Let's take the whole country. And it's in this atmosphere, and Polk is not totally against this idea. He's open to the idea of maybe taking more territory from Mexico. After all, they can't really do much at this point, in his opinion. And it's in this atmosphere that Trist realizes that if he doesn't negotiate a settlement with Mexico, things are really going to go downhill.
And how many casualties had there been? I mean, if you look at the entire Mexican War in terms of Americans, Mexicans, civilians.
That is a great question. No one is exactly sure how many Mexicans were killed. The number of Mexican civilians killed was not a lot. It was, you know, would number in the hundreds. It wasn't more than that. There are less than 2,000 U.S. soldiers who are killed in this war. But given the percentage of the number of soldiers that went there, it is, in fact, the most deadly conflict that the U.S. is involved in.
And something like 10 times as many were done in by measles and smallpox and dysentery.
Yellow fever, dysentery.
Like 11,000.
Dysentery is really, really bad. And, I mean, I've seen estimates for Mexican casualties around 20,000.
How generous was this treaty then to the United States?
Well, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo basically established that the territory that the United States controlled already, that is basically what we think of as the continental United States with the exception of a small portion of Arizona, which is later purchased in 1853, 1854 in the Gadsden Purchase. This is territory that the U.S. pretty firmly controlled by the middle of 1847. California, New Mexico, Texas's boundary down to the Rio Grande is established. It's not really a surprise what ends up being handed over. Almost half of actually Mexico's entire territory is handed over to the United States. What is interesting about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is that the United States pays Mexico $15 million for it. And Grant later calls this conscience money.
No, I so wondered.
It's an interesting thing to conquer another country and then pay them for the territory that you have conquered. And that's what the United States does. And interestingly, James K. Polk attempted to buy California from Mexico when he first entered office, and he offered them $30 million for it.
Well, now it's a kind of a distress sale.
Very much so.
When you look at the discussion of the war and the way people are talking about it, do you get the sense from the American side that racism toward the Mexicans is part of what is going on? In other words, we're not doing the same north of the border with Canada.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. There's no question. It's a sad and a very interesting point about this war that Manifest Destiny in large part is motivated by racism. People very firmly believe that Mexicans should not be entitled to their land because they can't make use of it. They're not morally up to the task. They don't have the ethic that people from the United States have. They're Catholic. They're racially inferior, and so they don't deserve their land. And, you know, you see even somebody as smart and intelligent as Walt Whitman claim that the war is going to be an easy victory because the Mexicans are imbeciles and they can't stand up to U.S. troops. And this is definitely part of what's going on. My colleague Mark Neely recently wrote a book claiming that the Civil War actually wasn't as destructive as many people think because – in comparison to the U.S.-Mexico War, soldiers on both sides of the Civil War recognized that they were the same race as the people they were fighting. So atrocities against civilians were limited with the exception of slaves. Slaves are treated extremely badly and Native Americans are treated horribly by both sides, but that there aren't that many atrocities against civilians in the Civil War compared to the way that many of the same soldiers had behaved in Mexico.
And that short period of time of the Polk administration pretty much finished off the entire territory of the 48 states, except for that little Gadsden Purchase that came a few years later.
He really did. And, you know, Polk, you could argue he was the most successful president in this country's history because he entered office and he had very clear goals and he basically achieved them.
We'll find out what happened to James K. Polk and we'll find out what happened to all those veterans of the Mexican War in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
For myself, I was bitterly opposed to the measure, and to this day regard the war, which resulted, as one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. That's the thoughts of U.S. Grant about the Mexican War. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking to Amy Greenberg about this conflict from 1846 to 1848, in which America acquired a lot of territory. You've been talking about some of the U.S. presidents that were involved in this conflict, whether it was Taylor or Polk or Grant or, you know, many different presidents had something to say about it. Did they all start to see that perhaps this wasn't such a just conflict? Or did someone like Polk that you were mentioning always see it as the righteous cause?
Well, Polk didn't live too long after he left office. Polk entered office in 1844. He said he was going to only serve one term, and he did. This was his war. It was the Democratic Party's war. But one of the kind of problematic things for Polk and for the Democrats was that the main generals in the war, the really heroic generals, Winfield Scott and Zachary Taylor, were both Whigs. They were known Whigs. So here we have Polk. He's fighting a war. There's increasing disapproval and anti-war sentiment growing in 1847 and into 1848. He's not running again. And he is pretty sure that the Whigs are going to get Zachary Taylor, old Rough and Ready, the hero of Buena Vista, to run in 1848. And in fact, Zachary Taylor does, and he wins. And so Polk is trying to somehow save this for the Democrats. He keeps trying to brevet some Democratic generals in the hopes that maybe one will step in and gain some acclaim. He undermines Taylor and Scott repeatedly. He doesn't get along with either of them. And personally, he hates that they're Whigs and the Whigs are making capital out of this war. One general that Polk attempts to bring to power is Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire. And Pierce, of course, becomes president in the 1850s. Pierce's performance in the Mexican War is not really that impressive. At one point, he falls off of his horse, and his opponents make a lot of hay from that for decades to come. Although Pierce did have the good luck of having Nathaniel Hawthorne as a close friend, and Nathaniel Hawthorne writes a campaign biography of him talking about how heroic his performance was in the Mexican War. But, you know, Taylor is sort of the leading general of the war. He's never really that supportive of the overall goals of the war, which is interesting. And he becomes president. Of course, he pretty quickly dies, which is unfortunate. And then Winfield Scott runs as the last Whig candidate in the 1850s against Franklin Pierce. So you know, a lot of people get a lot of mileage out of this war. But in the end, it's really the Whigs who end up winning out. Even their party implodes in the 1850s, in large part because of the sectional animosities that emerge out of the Mexican cession territory and trying to decide what the status of slavery will be in those territories. It's their view that this was an unchristian war, a war fought for the expansion of slavery, a war that Grant says is an unjust war fought by a stronger against a weaker neighbor. That view ends up being the mainstream view after the Civil War.
There are a couple of instances of, what would you call them, martyrs or symbols that come out of this war, I mean, from fairly humble places. The one is a Major Ringgold who tends to tumble through history as a major image from the Mexican War. He was what I gather an artillery commander who had both legs blown off in one of the battles and insisted on staying on the field until he died. And he turns up in, for example, verse 9 of the Maryland State Song.
Although I doubt many people in Maryland could tell you who Ringgold was.
Know that particular verse, but come, 'tis the red dawn of the day, Maryland, come with thy panoplied array, Maryland, with Ringgold's spirit for the fray, with Watson's blood at Monterey, with fearless Lowe and dashing May, Maryland, my Maryland. And a couple of other songs as well. There's one called Zack's Bayonet Boys. It has three verses dealing with Ringgold. So although there's no Alamo for this Mexican War, I suppose because it was so easy in many ways for the United States, there are these little images that come out of it.
There are images in both the Battle of Buena Vista and Cerro Gordo are widely illustrated. There's a lot of wonderful prints that are produced at the time that were circulated around the United States and hung up in people's homes and in bars. And for a moment in time, it is a popular war, but Ringgold kind of disappears. Buena Vista disappears. And in part, that's because the Civil War is, it's really just a more monumental conflict.
And a more moral one, you could argue.
You could argue.
Is Spain paying any attention, by the way, to what's going on with the Mexican-American War?
Yeah, Spain is fairly powerless. It's on the sidelines, yes.
And but is it involved in any way?
It isn't. And poor Mexico really thinks it can actually get Spain to come in on its side, and Spain won't have anything to do with it.
That whole history, it seems to me, of from about 1800 to 1850 has a lot to do with Spain's weakness. I mean, Jackson got Florida from Spain because they couldn't really administer it, and this whole Mexican-Texas war because
and
Spain had a loose
Spain loses
grip.
Every single one of its North American possessions with the exception of Cuba and Puerto Rico in
what
this time period.
What was the outcome for the veterans of this war? I mean, if it was so popular, at least for a time, how do they fare compared to veterans of earlier wars?
I think one of the most puzzling things about this war is the fact that the veterans are treated very, very shabbily after it. After the Civil War ends, Union soldiers who fought in the Civil War organize in the Grand Army of the Republic, and they're very successful at promoting their cause and their rights and fighting for pensions and fighting for the rights of soldiers. And the Mexican veterans attempt to do the same thing, and they utterly fail. Congress refuses to give money to build monuments to the Mexican War. Congress refuses to grant pensions to Mexican War veterans on the same terms that, say, veterans of the War of 1812 are getting, Civil War veterans are getting, even veterans of the Indian conflicts, which we tend to not think about as wars but are going on at the same time. The Mexican War veterans don't get them. And this is part of the sort of ascendancy of the Whig belief that it's an immoral war. There are a lot of Confederates among Mexican War veterans, and people in Congress call attempts that Mexican veterans make to get pensions, they call it a Southern war claim. It's a way of Southerners to get around the fact that they fought in the Confederacy.
Well, what about the Northerners who fight in the Mexican War?
Well, exactly. War? That's exactly right. They get nothing. They get nothing. So they're treated badly. I think a really interesting moment in the life and memory of the U.S.-Mexico War and the memory of U.S. veterans and the way they're treated is 1898, which is the 50th anniversary of the conclusion of the U.S.-Mexico War. And, you know, we today, of course, venerate World War II veterans and the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. You saw this outpouring of excitement and enthusiasm and veneration for World War II veterans, which they, of course, very much deserved. But there's nothing like any idea that the greatest generation deserves some acclaim in 1898. You know, no one's saying, oh,
well, we have this other glorious little war we're involved in, for one thing.
We have another glorious war. And I've looked closely at the way people talk about the Spanish-American War in the run-up to the war. And you would think that people would point to the Mexican War 50 years earlier and say either, you know, the Mexican War was terrible. We fought it on immoral grounds. We fought it for territory. We don't want to do that again. Or they would say, hey, look how easy it was for us to win an empire against non-white people, non-white Spanish speakers. Let's do it again. But nobody really talks about it at all.
So do you see parallels then between the treatment of the veterans of the Mexican-American War and treatments of veterans of the Vietnam War?
Oh, I absolutely do. I absolutely do. And one really interesting parallel is that in the case of the Vietnam War, it's when word of atrocities gets back home that people start really getting anti-war fervor really amps up. And you see something similar happening in the U.S.-Mexico War. And certainly in the aftermath of the war, opponents of the war, again, who are in the political ascendancy, say, you know, the soldiers, they didn't treat Mexican civilians very well. Nobody's proud of the war in general. And they – well, let's put it this way. In both wars, these are veterans who nobody really wants to think about. They'd rather forget about them.
What finally in the case of the dialogue, let's call it, between slave and free, what was the effect of the Mexican War? I mean, we have slavery in Texas. What about those other territories?
It's terrible. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, he said in 1846, he said, America will conquer Mexico, but Mexico will poison us. And what he was speaking to was the fact that gaining land from Mexico to the South is going to open up the whole can of worms, which is the expansion of slavery to the West. And the annexation of Texas starts it once the United States gains the Mexican Cession Territory, what is then called New Mexico and California. Once we gain that, Zachary Taylor, of course, has become president. We need to figure out whether or not there's going to be slavery or not in those territories. California, of course, is undergoing the gold rush. Its population explodes overnight, and California needs to be admitted as a state. And Zachary Taylor, again, who's a Whig, he is a slave owner himself, he sort of just decides on his own that slavery is inappropriate to the territories that have just been won at such great loss of life and so much effort. And he basically says, you know, I don't think there should be slavery in either California or the New Mexico territory. They should both be slave-free. And this touches off a sectional conflict representatives of Deep South slaves start talking about secession. This is 1850 that this happens.
And it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's at a Virginian who's saying this.
It's a Virginian slave owner. Yeah.
And so if you look back then at this Mexican-American War that maybe doesn't get as much attention as it deserves in the history books, what do you see as the most important things to remember from it?
The most important things to remember about the U.S.-Mexico War, first of all, is that it happened. The lands that we think of as American once belonged to Mexico and were taken from Mexico under very questionable claims. The other two things that are important to know about this war is that the United States did have imperial ambitions in the middle of the 19th century. We went to war in order to gain territory, in order to create an empire. And in fact, when the Mexican War was resolved, a lot of people said, hey, we won an empire. This is one thing that the veterans say. They say in their defense, they say, look, nobody remembers that we won an empire for the United States. We like to think that imperialism doesn't start until the Spanish-American War, but I don't think that's true. And then obviously the most important thing about the Mexican War is the fact that, as Emerson says, it did poison us. Most historians have claimed that the road to the Civil War starts with Texas and starts with the Mexican War. It's at that point that the second party system falls apart. People start voting according to what section of the country they live in, not the political parties that they belong to their entire lives. And it's very hard to resolve those issues. And ultimately, we go to war over them.
You know, it's intriguing that this is the, other than the revolution, of course, this is the only chunk of geography that we do go to war over in the sense that Louisiana is purchased.
Yes.
That whole vast
yes.
territory. And, of course, we bought the Gadsden Purchase in 1853, that chunk. And Florida, we
yeah.
sort of – we paid for it.
Yeah.
You know. It's kind of intriguing that Americans didn't try that same strategy and just say – to the Mexicans, look, there's so many Americans here.
They
You're going to lose
did.
Control of it anyway.
This is actually, I'm really
it.
Glad you brought this up. Polk and the presidents before him all tried to buy California and all tried to buy New Mexico from Mexico. And Mexico refused to sell. They refused to sell.
Should
they
have.
Were repeatedly offered very generous terms for this land. And one historian wrote, you know, pretty convincingly that, in fact, had the United States had better diplomats, we could have gained all of the land that we took from Mexico in the war. We could have gained it through purchase with better diplomacy.
That seems to be what Grant is saying in
oh,
his
absolutely.
Remarks there. Our guest has been Amy Greenberg, illuminating the Mexican War. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Been a great pleasure. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Catherine Kautsky is our guest at the piano, talking and playing us through Vienna in the early 19th century and the early 20th century. I guarantee contrast and fascinating conversation. Hope you'll join us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.